Chapter 30. Ross May got home to find that Mel was out again. He was going to text her, but in the end he phoned. She picked up his call almost immediately. He could hear voices in the background and was aware of his body relaxing. She was out with her mates. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing for him to worry about, to obsess about.
Where are you?
Despite his relief, the tension he'd felt when he'd arrived in the house and found it empty was still there in his voice. He could hear it and was about to apologise. He didn't want to be one of those men who couldn't trust their wives, who wanted to control them. But she answered before he could explain.
It's Joanne's birthday. I told you we were all going out straight from work.
There was a hint of resentment, of the defiance that he'd picked up over the weekend.
Oh, of course, sorry, it's this case sending everything out of my mind.
Now the apology sounded forced and lame.
Have a brilliant time and send her my best wishes.
He didn't think he could ask her now what time she planned to be back. In the end, she wasn't late. He'd been listening out for her all evening, for the footsteps on the drive through the open window, for the key in the lock. He'd stuck a ready meal in the microwave and opened a beer. He'd finished the meal but was still nursing the bottle when he heard her. He'd limited himself to one because Mel might need a lift. He'd hoped she might text him, asking him to pick her up, or to come out to join them. He'd switched on the television before she came into the room. He didn't want her to know he'd been waiting for her. She must have changed at work for the evening out because she looked gorgeous, in a sleeveless cotton dress and sandals, with a small wedged heel, simple and classy.
Good night.
Yeah,
she says. I'm knackered, though. It was another crazy day at work. I might just head up to bed.
She didn't seem drunk, not even a little bit tipsy.
Why don't you have a quick drink with me before you go? I haven't seen you properly for days.
Nah, she said. I'm on earlies again tomorrow.
Just one drink.
That tone in his voice again. Bossy, controlling. Where had it come from?
Please.
She hesitated and he thought she might refuse. He was already feeling the shame of having a simple request turned down. From Mel, who claimed to love him, who in the past would have done anything for him. In the end, she smiled.
All right then. There's a bottle of white already open in the fridge. I'll have a small glass of that.
He jumped to his feet and went to the kitchen to pour it for her. When he came back, she'd slipped off her sandals and was sitting with her feet curled under her on the sofa. She took the glass of wine and leaned against him when he sat down beside her. Of course, he was pleased that balance and order had been restored, but there was a seed of anger in his mind, because he was her husband, and she shouldn't have made him feel like that, so anxious and so impotent, so needy. In bed, she put her arms around him, but he was the one to turn away and pretend to sleep. The next morning, everything seemed back to normal. They had breakfast together and chatted about everyday things, putting the bins out, what he might like for dinner, when they might go to see Mel's family. Ross found himself hyper-alert, though. It was as if he was on a case, looking out for any discrepancy in the evidence. That germ of anger and suspicion was there, even when he was smiling, and when Mel bent down to kiss him before she rushed off to work. When he got to the station, Ross found he'd already received an email from his friend Steve Barton. Steve was a digital forensic expert, registered with the police service. He'd worked for a forensic science company in the Midlands on cybercrime, but recently he'd come home to keep an eye on his dad, who had chronic arthritis. They didn't live together. Steve always said he needed his own space to work, but at least he could help out. Ross was proud to be mates with such a brain box, happy to bask in the reflected glory of his success. They'd known each other since school. Steve had been a geek even then, a demon gamer and maths nerd. They'd got on okay and had stayed in touch after Steve went to London to university. Now he was back, Ross had put some work his way, and when that had turned out well, he'd persuaded Joe Oldham to spread the word countrywide. Barton was known now as someone who could deliver on anything cyber-related. Ross made sure that all the approaches to Barton went through him. He'll rush it through as a favour. Otherwise he'd be waiting for weeks, making himself indispensable. Barton's email was brief.
I've had a quick look. If you want to meet up, I'll talk you through it. I can do a report, but you won't get that until the end of tomorrow.
lots of other work on. Maybe that was boasting, playing a kind of hard to get, but Ross didn't want to take the risk by saying he'd wait. He imagined standing in front of the room at the evening briefing, passing on a vital piece of evidence. He emailed, "Where and when?" The reply came straight back. "The Dog and Ferret at 1. You can buy me lunch." The Dog and Ferret was classic Steve Barton. Eccentric, an old man's pub where the customers sat with their pints of mild, reading yesterday's free newspaper and grousing about the young. Pasties were the only food on offer. Steve had always haunted bizarre places, making friends with people Ross would never be seen dead with. He was already there when Ross arrived, at a table in a dusty corner. The pub was almost empty. Two elderly women were sitting in the window, drinking big glasses of white wine. One had her little finger raised, a mockery of a posh person drinking tea. They stared through the smeared window into the street, and for all the time Ross was there, neither of the women spoke. Steve could have been a surfer. His blonde hair was too long and he needed a shave. He wore a loose t-shirt so well washed that any logo had faded, and frayed jeans. He had a friendship bracelet on his wrist and sandals on his feet. Anywhere else, Ross would have been embarrassed to be seen in his company, but nobody he knew drank in the Dog and Ferret. "What have you got for me?"
"At least you can buy me lunch. I'll have a pasty and another pint of the bitter."
"I thought you were snowed under."
"Hey, a man's got to eat."
Ross came back with the pint, an orange juice and 2 pasties. Steve started talking while his mouth was still full.
"Your guy never saved much on his system, and he deleted everything before he topped himself."
He wiped a spray of pastry from the front of his shirt.
"I suppose you would, wouldn't you? I mean, you wouldn't want your family seeing all the dodgy porn sites you've been on."
"It's not the porn sites I'm interested in. Are you saying you can't access his accounts?"
"Of course not," Steve beamed. "These days we can access anything. Last month, I destroyed a defendant's alibi by showing he'd used a smart app to start his washing machine remotely. His neighbour had said he must have been in that evening because she could hear the machine going, but in fact, he was 30 miles away."
He paused, a stand-up waiting for applause that never came.
"Digging around on your guy's laptop was a piece of piss."
"So, let's hear what you got." Steve had always been a smart-ass. "I'm in the middle of a murder investigation. I'm not like you, I can't spend all day in the pub."
"You said you were interested in the few weeks before Mackenzie died. The man had a Gmail account and from that he sent stuff to his close family and did routine transactions. Pretty boring. Happy birthday to his gran, some purchases from Amazon. The day before he went missing, he'd sent a photo of himself in a garden to his mum and his sister."
Steve paused.
"The wider Google account's a bit thin, to be honest. But then most of the family communications would get sent by text these days."
He looked up.
"I could check out his phone if you have it."
Ross shook his head.
"We think it drowned with him." "That's more difficult then. His service provider will be able to give you contacts and the length of calls, but I don't think you'll get much else. Not the content of texts, for example. And he'd probably be sending photos by WhatsApp and that's encrypted end to end."
He paused.
"Are you sure the phone is gone?"
"It wasn't at the top of the cliff where he left his note, and the family say it's not in the house. I suppose a passing walker could have nicked it, but more likely, I think, that he had it with him when he jumped.
Because I might be able to track it down otherwise."
Steve had already almost finished his second beer.
"I could use cell site analysis. If you give me the details, it should be possible to map any journey the phone's taken too. At least then you'd know the guy's movements on the night he disappeared."
"Cool." But Ross thought they already knew that, because they'd found the man's outer clothes and his note, and Ven, a stickler for detail, had had the handwriting analysed. It had definitely been written by Mac Mackenzie. Ross thought about the emailed photo sent to Janie and Martha. The picture of the garden in the email attachment. Has it got a house in the background? A red brick farmhouse?
"Yeah, that sounds about right. He's standing there with an older guy. Fat. I'll send it across with the report."
Ross thought about the pictures of Nigel Yeo's contacts, the ones posted on the board in the ops room. It sounded as if Mac had been standing next to Frank Lay. "When was that photo sent?" Steve fished in his jeans pocket and pulled out an envelope with some scribbled notes on the back. The day before you told me he'd died. It was a selfie. The two guys standing together.
Is that it?
Ross was disappointed. When he'd got the call from Steve, he'd hoped for more than that. For revolutionary news to break open the case. He already knew that Mac had worked for Leigh as a jobbing gardener, and that he'd visited Westercombe to see Wesley Curnow in the days before his suicide.
No? What do you take me for?
Steve made out he was hurt.
I told you, I'm the best.
Mackenzie had a separate email account, one that he used for a completely different set of contacts. People that he'd met in a chat room. That was harder to track down, even for me.
A group promoting suicide?
Well, supporting people considering it. They use the hashtag Peace at Last, and that's the name of the chat group.
Steve looked up.
But within the Peace at Last forum, there seems to be a core group who call themselves the Suicide Club. Pretty sick, if you ask me. Images of people look as if they're about to do the deed. One picture of a woman, a noose around her neck, claiming she's only minutes from hanging herself. Another giving a list of over-the-counter meds and the amount you'd need to take to finish yourself off. It could all be fantasy. Like, if you're sharing all that stuff, maybe that's enough, you know? You're telling the world, or the members of the Suicide Club at least, how much you're hurting and getting the sympathy in return, so you don't actually need to do it.
Alexander Mackenzie did it, Ross said. Late at night or early one morning, he jumped off a cliff into the sea and drowned. His body was washed up on Lundy a week later.
Shit, of course he did.
They sat for a moment in silence. One of the women by the window went to the bar and ordered two more large glasses of wine. Ross wondered if they were as miserable as Mac and were killing themselves slowly. Perhaps the booze was giving them peace at last.
Can you send over a list of contacts, the other individuals who were in the same group?
Sure.
Steve's mood had suddenly switched, become sombre. He finished his drink and stood up.
Sure. I'll get onto it now.
Walking back to the station, Ross phoned Mel. He wanted to tell her that life was too short for misunderstandings, that they needed to spend more quality time together and to get back to how they'd been when they were first married, that he was sorry. But she didn't answer, and all he heard was a recorded message of her voice.
Chapter 31. Jen Rafferty got permission from Ven to go back to Westercombe to visit Eve Yeo.
I just want to check she's okay. I know a family liaison officer has kept in touch, but she's had such a tough time.
Good plan. Matthew was sitting at his desk, shirt sleeves rolled up, tie slightly loosened. Jen knew Jonathan teased him about the tie. Eventually, Jonathan had told her, he would persuade Matthew to come to work without it, but she couldn't imagine it happening any time soon. Matthew looked up. Talk to the Greaves, too. It'd be interesting to know if they were friendly with Mac. As we're following the line of inquiry that Yeo was threatening to expose the suicide chat room, it'd be good to check out all Mac's contacts, browsing histories.
Sarah doesn't strike me as suicidal.
Nor me, but belt and braces, you know how I like to work.
Oh yes, she thought. I know.
Her husband seems less straightforward, though, Ven went on. And talk to Frank Leigh. I'm the only person he's had contact with so far. I'd like your opinion of him.
Ven paused.
He might find you less intimidating than me, easier to talk to.
Jen smiled. She thought there were few people less intimidating than Matthew Ven. It was one of the reasons he was such a good interviewer. Witnesses felt they could confide in him. But he was the boss.
Okay, she said.
Sure.
The farmyard had been opened again. No tape, no officer on the gate. Jen squeezed her car past the milk tanker and parked by the workshops. Wesley's studio was shut and padlocked, but the door to Eve's was open. Jen knew that Sarah Grieve had been in to scrub the floor and the walls, a sign of real friendship, and Jen could smell a faint trace of disinfectant. Eve was working with her back to Jen, twisting a metal pipe with a globe of molten green glass at one end, shaping it with a gloved hand. Jen could feel the heat of the furnace from where she was standing by the door.
Hiya.
Who is it?
Eve didn't turn around. Sorry, this is almost impossible to do on my own. I need to concentrate. Jen Rafferty, I can come back in a bit, or help. But give me 20 minutes, then I'm all yours.
Jen went back into the yard and walked round to the front of the big house. She knocked at the door. No answer. Lay's garage was open and she saw his flashy Range Rover inside. He couldn't have gone far. The vehicle was black, like the car Janie had noticed racing through Instow. Jen made a mental note to tell Ven in case he hadn't noticed the vehicle's colour. Waited a moment, then knocked at the front door again. There was still no response, so she walked to the long window and looked in. She'd always been nosy, always loved these glimpses into other people's lives. Her favourite time of year was early autumn, when people put their lights on but forgot to draw their curtains. She'd walk down a street and each window held a moment of domestic drama. There was still no sign of Lay. Jen thought she'd talk to the Greaves and come back later. Sarah was working in the long, low building she used as a dairy. She shouted out as soon as Jen opened the door. You can't come in, you're not properly dressed for food prep. She was wearing a white overall and hairnet, and looked very like one of the CSIs in their scene suits. Jen had a glimpse of stainless steel counters and bowls. Sorry. Again, it seemed that she was intruding, interrupting the useful activities of others. This might be a wasted morning. She took a step back into the yard and raised her voice.
Have you seen Mr. Lay? Not since yesterday evening. He had us all in for drinks, a sort of belated wake for Wesley and Nigel. He invited the Mackenzies along too because he wanted us to remember Mac at the same time. He said the negligent treatment that Mac had received made his death a kind of unlawful killing too. Look, can you come to the cottage in a bit? I'll be stopping for coffee in half an hour or so. Cool.
Jen thought she might just sit in the sun for a while to catch a few rays, because she hadn't stopped working for days. And anyway, who would know? She was looking in her bag for her sunglasses when Eve stuck her head out of the workshop. I'm all yours. A low wooden bench stretched along the front of the workshops, and Eve sat there with her back to the wall. She tapped the top of the bench with her hand. This is one of Wes's creations. I helped him carry the plank up from Instow. It was driftwood, washed up on the beach. He found it early one morning and called me down to bring it back. Jen sat beside her. I just wanted to see how you are. Better now that I can get back into the studio. The work I'm making's crap, but it's an escape. You have to concentrate so hard, especially if you're working solo, that there's no space in your head for anything else. You're okay working there? Meaning, where you found your father's body? There was a moment of silence.
Yeah, Eve said. In a way, it's comforting. There are so many happy memories of us here together. That last image just feels like a nightmare, not real.
And you don't mind staying at Westercombe on your own?
I'm not on my own, though, not really. Sarah's like a mother hen, and the twins are very sweet. She lends them to me for company and cuddles. Then Frank had us all into his place last night.
Sarah said, kind of wake.
Were you all right with that?
Jen thought it must have been weird, a repeat of the evening before she'd found her father dead in her workshop. Eve shrugged.
He did ask me first. And, yeah, I was in the mood to get pissed. I thought it was probably better to do it in company than on my own. I wish he hadn't asked the Mackenzies along, but it would have been churlish to object or to stay away. In the end, they were okay, really supportive.
Do you know where Mr. Lay is now? I need to speak to him.
Probably sleeping off a hangover. He had even more to drink than me.
Eve paused, squinting into the sun.
That wasn't really like him. It was quite sweet, really. He got a bit emotional, made a little speech about the three dead men.
There was a moment of silence. Sarah came out of the dairy and looked as if she was about to approach them, then thought better of interrupting and headed for her cottage.
I have nightmares, Eve said, about finding them both. Every night it's the same, the glass and the blood. And you know, it's not the bodies that upsets me. In the dream, I mean, of course, not when I wake up. It's the broken glass, the wasted art.
We can help you find someone to talk to, someone who's used to working with victims, people who've been through trauma.
I know, the family liaison officer said, and I will take up the offer, but I'm not ready yet. She nodded towards the workshop. At the moment, this is all the therapy I need. Jen stood up. How well did you know Alexander Mackenzie, the lad who killed himself? He did Frank's garden, so I saw him around, and I got to know him quite well over the years. Sometimes I'd take him out a coffee or a cold drink, and we'd chat while he took a break. I liked him. He was a gentle soul, open, like a child, but in a good way. Wesley knew the rest of the family better than I did, though. Something about her voice made Jen ask, You don't like them? The others? You said you weren't happy that Frank had invited them to the do last night. I just don't think they were as happy as they all made out. They present this image, the devoted couple, arty and a bit glamorous. Then there's Janie, who went off to Oxford, the perfect daughter, brainy and beautiful. But underneath it feels a bit rotten. Like the image is all that matters to them, and there's something festering that nobody's willing to talk about. She paused. I've always had a vivid imagination, though. She gave a little smile. Perhaps it isn't like that at all. There was another moment of silence. Besides, I shouldn't be so unkind. They've lost a son, a brother. In the cottage, Sarah had already made coffee. She slid a mug over to Jen. She was sitting back in her chair with her hands on her belly, and Jen felt a moment of envy. She'd loved being pregnant, and the early months of being a mother. It was only as the kids had grown into toddlers, demanding and impossible to keep still, that life had become difficult. Robbie had hated the mess and the disruption to his routine, the fact that he could no longer be the centre of her attention. He'd grown tense and angry, and her life had become a battle to keep him happy, to prevent the increasingly frequent outbursts of temper. She wondered for a moment what it would be like to have a child with somebody calmer. Robbie had always called her a crap mother, and she had believed him. But perhaps it could be different. Then she remembered the teething and the screaming, the sore nipples and having absolutely no time to herself, and she set the idea aside. When are you due? Oh, I've got a couple of months yet. I'm just a fat cow. You're not having twins again? Oh, God, no, imagine. But she didn't seem so horrified by the idea, and gave a little complacent laugh. Jen thought Sarah would never consider herself a crap mother. Did you know Alexander Mackenzie, the young Instow man who killed himself? Handsome Mac. When he started working for Frank, I had a few fantasies about him, of the Lady Chatterley variety. But he was hardly more than a boy, and really a very troubled soul. Frank was so fond of him, and desperately upset when he killed himself. I guess that's why he asked the family up last night. She paused. He did kill himself. You're not linking his death with these murders. No, nothing like that. But Nigel Yeo was investigating a complaint from the family, who think he was let down by the health service. We found out that Mac was using a suicide forum on the internet. You don't know anything about that? Sarah shook her head. We certainly never discussed anything personal. We weren't on those sorts of terms. He seemed very shy to me, cut off from the real world. He only came alive when he was talking about plants and the garden. He might have talked more to Eve. He seemed to treat her almost as a big sister. She paused. He was really poorly the last time I saw him. He'd come up to talk to Wesley and he was in such a state, tears running down his face. He was banging on the door of Wesley's workshop, but Wes was in his flat. Wes did come into the yard to see what was going on, but he was never very good with dramas like that. And in the end, it was Frank who calmed Mac down. They sent for Janie and she took him home. Another pause. It was a terrible tragedy, but I wasn't surprised when he killed himself. He was let down by the service, which should have been there to protect him. Jen thought this confirmed everything she'd been told by the Mackenzie family. It was useful, but it provided nothing new. She changed tack. How do you sell your dairy produce if you don't have a shop? We supply local delis and restaurants, Sarah said, but we'd have a much better profit without the middleman, hence the idea for the tea shop. I suppose Frank Lay would have been useful providing those retail contacts, though, because he set up those kinds of outlets all over the county. Yeah. Sarah pulled herself upright. But we don't want to depend on Frank. Like I said before, John's got this thing about us being independent. In the meantime, we're building up a great online profile, and we're doing more and more sales by mail order. John's a bit of a computer whiz. He set up the site and spends most evenings in the upstairs spare room sorting out the orders. Not quite sure what he'll do when the baby arrives and we have to use the space as a nursery. He was grumpy enough when I booted him out for a few days to paint it. Jen considered that and wondered what else John Grieve might be doing online. Was he the sort of man who might enjoy power at a distance? She could see that he might, when he was so dependent on a benefactor in his everyday life. Could John Grieve be sitting each night in a cramped small bedroom, listening to desperate people planning to end their lives, pushing them occasionally to make the decision? Could that be his idea of entertainment, of fun? Where's John now?
I'm not sure, Sarah said. He went out straight after breakfast. There's always something to do on the farm. He'll be back when he's hungry. It's already gone his usual lunchtime.
She got to her feet, collected the mugs and set them on the draining board.
I should get back to work too. I think I've got hours at the beginning of the day, then in no time I have to rush off to collect the kids from school.
Jen nodded.
Of course. Thanks for the coffee.
She was wondering if she could find an excuse to go up to John's makeshift office, but surely there'd be nothing for an untrained eye to see. Only a room painted ready for a baby, perhaps with a mobile hanging from the ceiling and a Moses basket in one corner.
Once again, she walked round the farmhouse to Leigh's front door. It was early afternoon and the heat seemed to bounce from the red brick. She thought the man must surely be awake by now, even if he'd been drinking heavily the night before. When there was still no answer, she peered through all the windows she could find. The living room was tidy, so unless Sarah had been in early to clean for him, he hadn't been in such a bad state the night before. That was another of Jen's markers for judging the extent of her inebriation, the ability to load the dishwasher before going to bed. She moved on and looked in another of the windows facing the garden. A large office, very high-tech, jarring with the architecture of the house. A sleek desk had been built along one wall, and it was filled with devices. Computer, printer, scanner. Perhaps Frank Leigh, single, wealthy, entitled, was a more likely candidate for the person playing God on the suicide chat room. Now she was losing patience. She went back to the door and thumped on it. Then she turned the handle and went inside.
Mr. Leigh!
The house felt shady and cool after the blasting heat. She pushed her head through the doors of the rooms she'd already seen from outside. On the office desk was a mobile phone. Surely the man couldn't have gone too far if he'd left that behind. She moved on through the house, all the time expecting Leigh to appear, angered by the intrusion. There was a kitchen, which must back onto the kitchen used by Eve and Wesley. It was dark, with a small window looking out to the side of the house, but again very streamlined and full of gadgets, a high-end coffee machine, a juicer, and a sleek stainless steel fridge. Upstairs there were four bedrooms. Three apparently were scarcely used and had the feel of an upmarket boutique hotel. One had probably belonged to Leigh's mother, because here there were a few personal touches. A faded wedding photo, a cross-stitched sampler of the alphabet. Leigh's bedroom was big, with long windows looking over the garden and out to a glimmer of sea in the distance. The bed had been slept in but not made. It had a shower. There was a damp towel folded on the rail. Clothes had been put on an elegant blue chair, but presumably Leigh had been wearing those the day before. There was still no sign of the man himself. Jen went outside again and walked across the lawn and past the borders as far as the boundary wall. It had occurred to her that someone who'd shared Mac's passion for gardening wouldn't be indoors on a day like this. She found a wheelbarrow half full of weeds, but they were dry and shriveled, and had obviously been there for some time. Leigh himself seemed to have disappeared.
Chapter 32. Matthew Venn was in his office, chatting to Ross, trying to make sense of the information the DC had gleaned from his techie friend. The space felt like a sauna, and he could feel sweat running down his back. He'd brought in a spare shirt and wondered when he might find a moment to change.
So Mac had accessed one of these suicide sites.
Yes, something called Peace at Last.
Ross paused. And we know those were the words Mac used in his suicide note. Luke Wallace had been a member too, so it's a well-established forum. The chat room seems relatively supportive, but Steve came across a core group who call themselves the Suicide Club, and Mac had been sucked into that too. They seem more actively determined to encourage members to kill themselves.
Do we know who pulled him in?
Ross shook his head. Steve says tracking down the other individuals will take time. Ben forgot his embarrassment, the heat and the sweat, and felt a wave of pity for the people who'd been desperate enough to consider suicide. He'd had a kind of breakdown after losing his faith. He hadn't just lost his God, but his community, cast out by his parents and the brethren. He'd even had a fleeting longing for the peace that death might bring, but that had been different from taking active steps to kill himself. He couldn't quite imagine that desperation. He turned back to Ross. It would be most helpful if Barton could give us the names of other people using the site, especially the person moderating the suicide club.
He said he'd work on it this afternoon.
His office door opened. No knock, and a shadow blocked out the light. Superintendent Joe Oldham, Matthew's boss.
Ah!
Oldham leaned against the doorframe as if the effort of walking down the corridor had been too much for him to remain upright.
Two birds with one stone.
The Yorkshire accent had remained unchanged and was a matter of pride.
How's it going then? I'm getting pressure from above. Always piggy in the middle, that's me.
His voice was an unpleasant whine. Ross has come up with some very useful information, Matthew said. We're about to follow it up. He'd learned that praising Ross and being vaguely optimistic was the best tactic where Oldham was concerned. The superintendent considered Ross a protege, and although Oldham insisted that he liked to be on top of a major operation, he'd never been much interested in detail.
I can tell Exeter we're near to an arrest then.
We're hopeful.
Grand?
The big man levered himself away from the doorframe and walked away, once more letting in sunlight.
Keep me informed.
They watched the large back disappear into the corridor. Ross's phone rang. He listened for a moment, then passed it to Ven.
It's Jen. She's been trying to get hold of you.
Ven felt for his phone, realised he'd left it in the pocket of the jacket he'd carefully put over the back of the chair in the main office.
Sorry, Jen. What's the problem?
I can't find Lay. The door to his house is open, but there's nobody in.
And nobody's seen him?
Not today. He had a gathering in his house last night. A kind of wake for Nigel and Wesley, and apparently for Alexander too, because he invited the rest of the Mackenzie family to Westerham to join them. I've been into the house. He definitely slept there last night, but neither Eve nor Sarah Grieve has seen him since.
What about John Grieve?
I haven't tracked him down either. According to Sarah, he's out on the farm somewhere.
I'll be over.
Ven ended the call and went to retrieve his jacket and his own phone. There was a missed call and a voicemail. From Frank Lay. It had been made more than an hour earlier.
If you're coming to Westerham this morning, Inspector, I wonder if you'd call in and see me. I'd welcome the chance for a chat.
The man sounded very tired, a little old. Ven called him back, but there was no reply. He remembered his previous anxiety when he'd not been able to find Lay, the sunlit walk across the common from the Instow Road, the strange panic as he imagined some tragedy at the farmhouse. He wondered if he was overreacting again by rushing off to Westerham, but still he checked that his phone was in his pocket, and he hurried to his car. Matthew found Jen sitting where Lay had been on that earlier encounter. She was flushed from too long in the sun. She had a redhead's pale complexion and her nose was peeling. The skin reminded him of flaky pastry. The remains of a croissant on a plate.
I had another look around the garden, away from the paths, in case he'd fallen. I haven't been back to the workshops in case he didn't want them knowing that Francis has buggered off.
She paused.
I suppose he only has one car. He couldn't have driven off in another vehicle.
Only one car registered, Ven said.
Do you think he's done a runner? He could have hired a car or got a taxi to the station. No vehicle's been in the yard while I've been here. But it could have come earlier or driven up his private drive.
She paused. His mobile's in his office, though. Surely you wouldn't have left that behind.
He phoned me earlier, then said, I missed a call.
Can you get onto the provider? Treat it as urgent. Find out who else called him this morning.
Jen nodded.
Ven tried to think his way through the possibilities. Why would he be running away? Why now, I mean? What's happened in the last couple of days to spook him?
He was sniffing round the old folks' home in Spennacott.
But according to Lauren, Yo had agreed with Lay that bringing the care home up to standard would cause more disruption to the residents than moving. It was clear to me that Reed, who made the complaint, had his own reasons for stirring up the campaign against Francis. Ven re-ran his visit to the model village in his head. Ven couldn't see that Lay would be particularly disturbed by the news that the police had been following Nigel's movements in the week before his death.
Lay held a wake here last night, Jen said, a celebration of the lives of Wesley and Nigel, and Mac. He invited the remaining Mackenzie family to join them.
Ven thought that was more interesting.
How did it go?
Frank got pissed and made a sentimental speech about all three blokes, according to Eve, but no rows or accusations. At least, if there were, she wasn't letting on.
She looked at her boss.
But a bit odd, don't you think? Throwing a party at a time like this?
Perhaps none of them wanted to be alone. Ven considered for a moment. It was too early to panic, to call for a full search.
Lay was an adult. He could easily have changed his mind after making the phone call to Ven's mobile when there was no reply. If he was troubled, there were surely other people in whom he might confide. He took out his phone and dialed Lauren Miller's number. It went straight to voicemail. He left a message.
This is Matthew Ven. If you pick this up, please could you call me back?
He imagined the two of them, Lauren and Frank, friends from London days, sitting in a smart Appledore restaurant, eating a late lunch. Frank would be leaning forward, earnest, sharing his sadness at the loss of two people close to him. There were, after all, very few people close to him.
Can you check local taxi firms? He said to Jen. See if anyone picked him up.
Sure. He was walking away from Jen when his phone rang. It was Lauren Miller.
Inspector, I'm sorry I missed your call. How can I help you?
I just wondered if you'd heard from Frank today. There was a silence at the end of the line.
Yes, she said. Yes, I have.
He was about to ask for more details when she continued talking.
If it's not too inconvenient, perhaps you'd have time to come and see me? This isn't an easy conversation to have on the phone.
Of course, I could come now.
Thank you.
She was as calm and measured as when they'd met previously, but he heard relief in her voice.
That would be very kind.
Chapter 33. Lauren was waiting for him. She was wearing a cotton dress that reached to her ankles and looked as cool as she'd sounded on the phone. Her feet were bare, long, and brown. She made him fragrant tea in a china pot, poured it through a strainer, and offered little sugary biscuits.
Thank you for coming, she said. Mother's out with a friend. We won't be disturbed.
You said you'd heard from Frank today. Did he come here to see you? He seems to have disappeared, and I thought you might have an idea where he might be.
No, he didn't come here, though perhaps I should have suggested that we meet.
There was a pause. She looked more uncomfortable than he'd seen her.
There were two phone calls. The first was in the early hours of this morning. I sleep very lightly, and though my mobile was on silent, the vibration woke me. Frank was drunk. It was all very awkward.
What happened?
She looked up, her cup still in her hand, and gave a little smile.
I suppose it was a declaration of love.
She shook her head as if the notion was ridiculous.
I told him this wasn't a conversation that I needed in the middle of the night, and I asked him, very politely, to call me back later in the morning when he'd had a few hours' sleep and a couple of mugs of strong black coffee.
Did he take your advice?
He did.
She took a deep breath.
The call came at 9 o'clock this morning. He was very apologetic for waking me the night before, very sweet. He told me that he'd always admired me and that Nigel's death had made him reevaluate things. Perhaps it was time for him to be braver emotionally, to express himself more openly. She paused again. He asked if we might become closer, if perhaps one day I might consider being his wife. She looked up. At least I didn't laugh. It took a lot of control, but I managed to keep serious. But really, it sounded ridiculous, like something from a Regency romance.
What did you say?
I thought the kindest thing was to be clear. I told him I'd always value him as a friend, but that I could never consider him as a partner. She sipped her tea and replaced the cup on the saucer. I told him about Nigel and me. I said that Nigel would always be the love of my life, and I couldn't contemplate the possibility of anyone replacing him.
How did he respond?
He was very quiet, Lauren said, rather cold and formal. He apologized for disturbing me, and he replaced the phone. Ven thought that explained Lay's disappearance. He'd gone away somewhere to lick his wounds. He'd been fantasizing for so long about this woman that she'd become a part of his life. This would feel a little like another bereavement. Would it explain Lay's phone call to him, though?
Would you mind if I ask some more questions while I'm here?
Of course. I'm happy to help in any way I can.
Did Nigel discuss Alexander Mackenzie's suicide with you?
A little.
We think he was interested in Mac's membership of a chat room that brought together people contemplating suicide. Do you know anything about that?
Lauren didn't respond immediately. I overheard a conversation between him and the mother of another victim of suicide, his side of the conversation at least. Later, I asked him what it was about. He was reluctant to tell me. He was always very careful about confidentiality, even where patients together was concerned. But I'd picked up most of it anyway.
What did he tell you?
That he'd discovered this group. They called themselves the Suicide Club. He said it wasn't a group where people with severe depression could share their experiences and support each other. It was a place where people were actively encouraged to kill themselves.
He was angry.
Angry and sad.
She looked at the huge seascape hanging on the wall, and Ven thought she was losing herself in it again, remembering Nigel Yeo, the love she'd found in middle age.
Angry that the major providers refused to close the chat room down, and sad that people were so desperate that they felt the need to use it.
She looked up. I've researched them and found my way into one or two.
What about the one used by Mac?
Yes, I found that one. Its official name is Peace at Last, but there's a tight group of a few individuals and a moderator within it. They call themselves the Suicide Club.
Ven nodded. He already knew that much.
Did you get the name of the moderator?
Only the name he or she uses online. They call themselves the Crow.
She paused.
I didn't have the expertise to track down the Crow's real identity. You need a security expert for that, and even then, I'm not sure it would be possible.
That would be for Ross's friend Steve.
Did you pass all this information on to Nigel?
Of course.
Was that soon before he died?
Not immediately before, perhaps a couple of weeks.
Ven wondered about that. If Yeo hadn't only recently discovered the impact of the Suicide Club, what had made him so angry on the Friday afternoon before his body was discovered? Ratner had described his mood as changing dramatically in the course of the day. Still, they had no idea of his movements that afternoon, except that he'd told Reed that it was a matter of life and death. Nothing quite made sense. Had Nigel learned anything new about the Mackenzie case on the day that he died?
I don't know, she said. I didn't see him. He'd asked if I wanted to go to Cynthia's party. He said he wanted to chat to her friend, the woman who's a police officer. I told him I'd rather wait until we'd told Eve we were a couple.
She looked up at Ven.
I think I explained all that when you were last here. In the end, Mother and I went out to dinner instead to a rather nice new restaurant in Appledore. I did have a text from him that Friday lunchtime, but there was nothing work-related. It was only catching up, just saying he was looking forward to seeing me over the weekend.
We really need to track his movements that Friday afternoon. He had a meeting at the hospital in the morning, and then another there at 4:30. But we don't know where he was in between. Do you have any idea where he went?
Lauren shook her head.
Sorry, I'm afraid I can't help.
Nigel had told Paul Reed, the Spennacott campaigner, that he'd go there that afternoon, but he called him to cancel. Do you know anything about that?
Ah.
She looked out of the window and into the garden. Nigel got involved in the Spennacott old people's home against his better judgment. In the end, he considered that the decision to close the mount was justified, though he said Frank could have been less hasty and should have involved the residents earlier. She paused. Nigel was sure he'd be able to negotiate a compromise, some sort of deal which would make everyone happy. He said that the writer, Paul Reed, was a poisonous little man stirring up trouble out of spite. But really, I have no idea why Nigel cancelled the visit. Do you know why Mr. Lay was in such a rush to convert the place? Matthew wasn't quite sure how that could be relevant to the investigation, but Frank's disappearance made him a potential suspect. Lauren thought for a moment. I think Frank saw Spennacott in the abstract, almost as a mathematical equation. The boutique hotel would benefit the community more than the old people's home, so that was the route to take. She looked up. He was looking at the greater good. If he'd actually visited the home and chatted to the residents, his perspective would probably have changed. He was passionate in his support for the campaign to get justice for Mac's family because he'd known him. I think Frank just didn't have the ability to make the imaginative leap, to put himself in the place of people he'd never met, like the care home residents. Venn nodded. There were people like that in the police service, people who understood the abstract better than the personal. He could well be one of them. They sat in silence for a moment. The shadows thrown by the trees in her garden were already lengthening. It would be a little cooler there. Soon he'd have to go back to Barnstable to meet up with the team and to see if Leigh had reappeared. "Have you heard that there's been another death?" he asked. "Yes, Wesley Curnow. I read about it earlier this week." "Did you know him?" "I'd met him a couple of times when Frank invited me to one of his Westercombe gatherings." She paused and looked up. "But really, I can't think why anyone would want to kill him." "What did Nigel make of him?" "Not very much. It wasn't in Nigel's nature to dislike people. He tried to understand them, but I think Wesley rather irritated him." "Did Nigel try to understand the other staff at Patients Together?" Lauren laughed out loud. "Perhaps not as hard as he should have done. But Steph and her cronies are very set in their ways. A lot of gossip goes on in that office and not a lot of work. I think Nigel was frustrated because he thought the organisation could achieve so much more." A pause. "And all the doctors I know have a confidence, a certainty that can make them appear arrogant." "What will you do now? Will you continue working for them?" "I still have to decide," Lauren said. "I might even apply to take over as CEO. It's Nigel's legacy in a way. I'd hate it to slide back to the way it was, to become a self-satisfied talking shop again. I couldn't remain in my present role with another boss. I'd find that impossible." She gave a little shake of her head. "I do have to ask," Matthew said, "because you knew both victims. What were you doing on Sunday afternoon, the afternoon Wesley died?" "Of course you do, Inspector." She gave the matter a moment's thought. "Mother and I went to visit a National Trust garden near Torrington. She might not be able to see, but she loves a garden, the scents and the touch of the plants. We had afternoon tea in the cafe there and arrived home at about 6 o'clock. So, it would be impossible, Matthew thought, for Lauren Miller to have stabbed Wesley Curnow in the shed behind the woodyard. He was pleased to have the confirmation, but he couldn't imagine the calm, thoughtful woman sitting opposite him as a killer. It was dark by the time Matthew arrived home. Driving back, he was thinking of his husband, picturing the peace of the house, hoping that the tension of the previous day had disappeared. He found Jonathan just where he'd imagined, sitting on the wooden bench outside the kitchen door, a glass in his hand. He would have heard Matthew's car, and there was a glass of very cold white wine waiting on the table beside him. The tide must be low, because there was no sound of water from the beach or the river. They sat without speaking, looking out at the stars. Chapter 34. Jonathan woke early and had been for a swim before Matthew got up. It had become a ritual in these hot, heavy days,
A quick run into the sea, a kickstart to the morning. It set him up for the meetings that filled much of his time at the woodyard. Today there was a gentle swell, and after 10 minutes of vigorous crawl, he'd lain on his back, held up by the salt water, looking at the sky until the cold had eased into his bones and sent him home. Back at the house, Matthew had made coffee and seemed to be waiting for him.
I thought you might already be in town.
Jonathan knew how much work, how much this particular murder meant to his husband. He'd expected him already to be in Barnstable at his desk. Matthew didn't answer directly. Are you busy this morning? So, Matthew didn't want to talk about the investigation. He was shutting Jonathan out again. Jonathan tried not to care.
No, I thought I'd go in a bit late. I'm owed masses of time.
I wondered if you'd come back to Westercombe with me. I've just phoned Jen and it seems Frank Lay still hasn't turned up, and there's been no sighting of him. We can't justify a big team to look for him. He wasn't a major suspect in either murder, but I'd like a proper search of the grounds around the house. It was dark before we could do it properly yesterday. You'd be on public ground, a volunteer. We sometimes ask volunteers to help in searches. It would be nothing official.
Of course.
Jonathan knew this was a big deal, a kind of peace offering. He phoned me yesterday morning and sounded a bit low, Matthew said. I'd hate it if he came back to a major fuss, uniformed officers doing a fingertip search, when all he needed was some time on his own.
I understand.
I didn't answer his call, Matthew said. Perhaps it was my fault that he went off on his own.
Dump the guilt, Jonathan wanted to say. Just dump the guilt.
Jen Rafferty was already there, waiting for them. Despite the heat, it was still early. The rest of the farm was quiet. How far did you go yesterday? Matthew asked her. We can carry on from there. Only as far as the wall. I didn't want to trespass. She looked sheepish. Besides, there might have been cows in the field. Jonathan couldn't help teasing.
You're scared of cows.
I'm a city girl, freaked out by any animal bigger than me. It's common land, Matthew said. There's a public right of way and there were no cows when I was there last time. A pause. You go and check the garden properly. We'll do the common and the wilder areas beyond the wall. They waited until she'd made a start before setting off. I'll take the path down to the Insto Road. Can you check the fields on either side? You find anything, you just call me. You don't touch anything. Jonathan nodded. He watched Matthew set off along the path through the garden before following. There was a hedge of lavender and the scent made him giddy, almost faint. In the wild flower meadow he slowed his pace. The path through was clear, but the clover and buttercups had grown so high that they might hide evidence that Lay had been here. At the stile across the wall leading to the common, Jonathan paused. Standing on the wooden frame, he had a better view. He could see the roof of the Westercombe farmhouse behind him, the ribbon of road below him, and Matthew, straight and purposeful, marching towards it. On the other side of the wall, the grass was shorter. Perhaps animals, sheep or horses, were allowed in to graze, but no animals were here now. The gorse was a sunburst of colour, so bright that it hurt his eyes. Jonathan crossed the common horizontally to his left, following the line of the wall. Soon he came to a barbed wire fence with a field of cows beyond. This land must be part of the farm. He retraced his steps to the right and came to a crumbling wall, much less well-maintained than that separating Lay's garden from the common. On the other side of it was a patch of deciduous woodland, shadowy and inviting. With the geography of the common fixed in his head, he began a proper search, moving backwards and forwards over the grass, peering into gorse thickets. All the time desperate to find something, knowing it was ridiculous, childish, but wanting to prove to Matthew that he could be useful. It almost felt like some sort of weird treasure hunt, with Matthew's approval as the reward. In the end, the man was lying not far from the footpath, but he was hidden by one of the thickets of gorse. He was lying on his back, staring up to the sky, just as Jonathan had done earlier, when he was floating in the sea. He was about to feel for a pulse, but remembered what Matthew had said. And this man had clearly been dead for a while. No need to touch him. Standing upright, he felt faint again for a moment, a little nauseous. It was the heat, the sound of bees on the blossom,
the sweet honey smell of the gorse. He made a mental note of the position of the body and ran to find Matthew, shouting down the hill at him until he turned and began to walk back, knowing that nothing he could say to his husband would make him feel better about Francis Leigh's death. They stood together at a distance from the body. Matthew had already been on the phone calling his team, the pathologist, the crime scene manager, the police officer taking over. No glass, Matthew said. If it's murder, it's not the same MO. He was talking to himself. No intelligent answer was expected. Do you want me to go? Jonathan didn't want to cause Matthew embarrassment by being here. Of course, if you're busy, if you should be at work, but you'll probably have to make a statement later. No, Jonathan said quickly. No, there's no rush. Matthew kept at a distance from the body, but he began to take photos on his phone of Frank Leigh, the surrounding gorse thicket, and a wide shot of the common. He was entirely concentrated on his work. He looks very peaceful, Jonathan said. He'd never been very good at silence. Yes. Matthew turned to look at him as if he'd said something of deep significance. You're right. Jonathan was about to walk back to the house when Matthew's phone rang. Matthew rolled his eyes as he answered, then put it on speakerphone and mouthed, "It's the boss." Oldham's words reverberated around the valley. You told me you were close to making an arrest, and now we have another bloody body. The man seemed to pause for breath. And not any bloody body, some high-profile wanker. The press will be here in swarms, wasps round a bloody jam pot, mosquitoes round a fucking open wound. Jonathan had met Oldham a couple of times and had taken an instant dislike. He pictured the man, tomato-faced, with as little self-control as a toddler in the middle of a temper tantrum, yelling into his phone. Oldham was still shouting. So, get on top of it, then. When I took you on, which was against my better judgment, they told me you were clever. So prove it. I need a result. The last sentence came out as such a scream that Matthew held his phone away from his ear. Jonathan heard the line go dead. He felt fury on Matthew's behalf. How can he speak to you like that? When you're already feeling guilty about missing the call from the man. Matthew shrugged and put his phone away. He won't be there forever. Good. Jonathan looked up and saw a white-suited figure heading towards them. Good. Brian Branscombe, Matthew said. Crime scene manager.
What have we got?
Branscombe was a local, his voice relaxed, easy. Not sure yet. I'm not convinced this is murder. Can you have a quick look, check his pockets, see if there's anything that tells us what's happened here? Jonathan watched Branscombe bending over the body. He felt like a voyeur, or that this was a piece of theatre. He thought again that he should go, that he was only in the way. But something held him at the scene. This was exciting, distasteful, but compulsive. Branscombe reached into an inside pocket and pulled out an envelope. He held it up so Matthew could see what was on the front. I think this is for you. In old-fashioned script and written with a fountain pen, Detective Inspector Matthew Venn. And then there's this. Branscombe held up a plastic medicine bottle. It was empty. He looked at the label. Amitriptyline, regularly prescribed antidepressants. And I think Sal Pengelly will confirm that taken in sufficient quantity, they can kill. They sat together in Jonathan's car while Matthew opened the letter. Jonathan had offered again to go back alone to Barnstable, to leave his husband to work in peace. He knew Matthew had always lived his life in compartments, and although his worlds had clashed big style in the previous investigation into the death of Simon Walden, his husband hated bringing together the personal and the professional. Asking Jonathan to help him look for Leigh had been a gesture of reconciliation, a small step to allow their worlds to mix. Neither of them had expected the search to end like this, with a body and a letter from the dead man. Now Jonathan wanted to be here to offer support. He knew Matthew was obsessed by the fact that he hadn't spoken to Leigh the day before, but he hoped Matthew wouldn't later regret the bending of rules. Matthew slit the envelope carefully along the top and he pulled out a single sheet of heavy, high-quality paper. The letter had been written with the same pen and ink as the name on the envelope. Matthew held it with gloved hands and read out loud. "Dear Inspector Venn, I must apologize for confusing your investigation with this act of suicide. I'd hoped to explain it in person, but when I couldn't get hold of you, writing seemed more appropriate after all. Life isn't worth living. My acts of generosity are no longer sufficient to make me less guilty, and the people that I cared for and felt I could help, Mac, Nigel, and Wesley, no longer need my support. I'm glad that I have the courage to find peace at last." Then there was a signature. "He doesn't mention Lauren Miller," Jonathan said. "He said she'd rejected him. Wouldn't that have been a trigger to his suicide?" "Of course. But he wouldn't have wanted her to feel the guilt that had haunted him." Matthew was quiet for a moment, and the next words were spoken almost in a whisper. "How will I tell her?" Then he was out of the car, suddenly strong and decisive again. "You should go," he said. "Of course, you won't discuss this with anyone. I need to make that phone call."
Chapter 35. Eve was walking from the house to her workshop when Jen Rafferty appeared around the side of the farmhouse. Something about her face and the way she was hurrying made Eve certain that there was bad news. Another blow. After believing that life couldn't get worse than this, she'd be battered again. "Can we go inside?" Jen's voice was breathless. So they were once again in the big ground floor kitchen, sitting almost exactly as they'd been after her father's death, and the whole episode came crashing back into Eve's head. She was paddling in blood again, staring at the shard of glass, feeling the heat of the furnace. "What?" she demanded. "What's happened now?" "We found Frank. I'm really sorry, but he's dead." At least, Eve thought, Jen had come straight out with it. None of those awful euphemisms people had used when her mother had died. Passed on, passed away, passed. As if, her father had said dryly after the visit of a particularly gushing neighbour, Helen had been asked to give a urine sample. The image of her father came bright and sharp into her head, and she had a brief moment of gratitude. She'd worried that she might lose a clear picture of him. "Did a piece of my glass kill him?" Eve thought she couldn't bear that, the strange sense that she was somehow complicit, that the victims would still be alive if it weren't for her work. Jen shook her head. "We're not entirely sure about the cause of death yet. We don't think that it was murder." She paused. "When did you last see him?" "The night before last, at that peculiar party." "You didn't catch a glimpse of him yesterday? Not even in the distance?" Eve tried to remember. These days, events seemed to run together and felt unimportant, irrelevant, overshadowed by memories of violence. She shook her head. "Where was he found?" "Near a gorse thicket on the common." "I wouldn't have seen him then. He'd have gone straight from his side of the house through the garden when I didn't go anywhere near." "Did you see anything unusual yesterday? Any strangers around the place?" "No," Eve said. "Nothing unusual happened at all. Except that my father and my neighbour have both died, and nothing will be the same again." There was a gentle knock on the kitchen door, and Matthew Venn walked in. He came and sat opposite Eve. Jen Rafferty got to her feet and muttered something about making tea. She disappeared from Eve's line of sight. Venn sat on the wooden chair across the table from her. Again, Eve braced herself for information she didn't really want to hear. "I wanted you to know," Matthew said, "before the rumours start flying. We're pretty sure that Frank killed himself. He took an overdose. He left a note." "Why would he do that? He had all this. His work." Eve found it hard to imagine jovial Frank being so desperate. "He was depressed," Matthew said. "He told me himself he had a history of the illness, and then all the chaos and the violence here. He found it hard to deal with all that on his own."
"He had us."
Perhaps that wasn't quite enough. In the background, Eve could hear the kettle coming to the boil, the clink of mugs. Matthew seemed to be reaching a decision to speak again. Eve thought there'd be more information about Frank Lay's death, but the question was quite different. "Do you know someone called Lauren Miller?"
Yeah, she worked for my dad.
Another silence. Again, Matthew seemed to be hesitating, uncertain whether to continue speaking. I phoned her about Frank's death. She knew him very well. They worked together in London. Frank introduced her to your father. She and your father were very close. She's here, and she'd like to talk to you. Eve struggled to understand what the detective was trying to say. Then it became clear. A flash of understanding that explained her father's recent moments of lightheartedness. How he'd started singing to himself again. His words when he'd offered to spend that last day working with her. Something rather wonderful has happened. I want to tell you all about it. She and Dad were lovers. Will you see her? Matthew asked. No pressure at all. She'll quite understand if not.
No. What does she think, that she can replace my mother? Or that she can possibly feel as deeply as I do about my father's dying?
But then the old politeness and a new curiosity took over. Eve nodded her head, and Matthew went off to call the woman in. Chapter 36. After she'd finished talking to Eve, Jen made her way back to the Greaves' cottage. The yard had already filled up with vehicles. She recognized Sally Pengelly's car and waved to her. Sarah was standing at the cottage door looking out.
What's going on?
She sounded anxious.
Is there a new lead? Do you know what happened to Nigel and Wesley?
Jen shook her head but didn't answer.
Where are the girls?
At school? As if the answer was obvious. Jen thought she was losing all sense of time.
And your husband?
He's just come in.
I need to talk to you both.
A van full of uniformed officers drove through the gate, pulling Sarah's gaze back to the yard. But she turned and went into the house. Jen followed. John Greave was standing at the sink, washing his hands. He was still in overalls and stockinged feet. The sink was under the window and he nodded outside.
What on earth's happening out there?
He turned away and took a towel from a hook behind the door.
Feels as if we're under siege. How long do we have to carry on like this?
There was an edge of aggression, even threat, under the voice, which made Jen wary. She recognized the danger signs.
For as long as it takes for us to catch a murderer.
She wanted to add something sarky.
Sorry for the inconvenience.
But after all, these people's lives had been turned upside down, and two of their friends had died. Now she had to tell them that there'd been another death. But not yet. First, she needed some information.
Where were you all day yesterday, Mr. Greave?
Jen kept her voice pleasant, polite.
Out working. The place doesn't run itself.
Jen sensed Sarah tense beside her. The woman was worried about the impression John was giving. Jen knew all the excuses. He's tired, stressed about the business, it's a bad time. Jen had had to explain her husband's moods to her friends for years, before things had become really bad and he seldom let her out.
Where exactly?
Honestly, I'm not being deliberately intrusive. I do have a good reason for asking. Greave looked at his wife and then back at Jen.
I went for a drive, he said, after milking. I needed to get away for a bit.
You didn't say?
This was Sarah, trying not to overreact. She wouldn't want to make a fuss in front of a stranger. Jen knew how that felt, too.
I wanted to look at that farm we had our eye on, the one on the edge of the moor, beyond Spennacott.
He paused.
I thought if Frank wants to create his grand model village there, he might support us, invest. We'd still be part of his empire, but at least we wouldn't be right in his backyard.
It would have been nice to know what you were doing.
No apology now. No anxiety about embarrassing themselves in front of Jen. The words were sharp and fierce.
So, she could fight back when she needed to. She wasn't as oppressed as Jen had been. Go, girl.
Yeah, he said.
Look, I'm sorry. I can't explain how tough I'm finding this, all living on top of each other. No kind of space or privacy, and having the police marching all over the place, the press lurking in the lane, just makes things worse.
Jen was tempted to ask if he was depressed, if he had contemplated using a suicide chat room, but she'd saved that question for when she had Greave on his own.
Did anyone see you?
She asked. I mean,
Did an agent show you round the farm, or the landowner? No. A pause. I just wanted to get a sense of the place, its potential. Do you know a writer called Paul Reed, who lives in Spennacott? He's been running a publicity campaign against Mr. Lay. I've never heard of him. Grieve was losing his cool now. Why do you want to know? What's going on? Why are all these people turning up in the yard? There's been another death. Jen watched their faces, tried to gauge if the information was new to them. But they both stood staring at her, blank and impassive. Shock, she thought. Perhaps. Sarah spoke first. Who? Frank Lay. It seems he went missing yesterday, and we found his body on the common beyond his house this morning. John spoke first. I wonder what will happen to this place. To us. Jen had been wondering about that too. She'd considered it while she was talking to Eve, though she'd thought the glassblower would be okay. She'd inherit her father's house in Barnstable and wouldn't be left homeless and without funds. And that might happen to this family. I suppose it depends if Frank had a will and who he left all his land and his money to. But Sarah was in tears. We shouldn't be thinking of that now. We're talking about Frank. I've known him since I was a baby. I loved him. She turned on her husband. How can you be so selfish? Because we have two daughters, and soon there'll be another child to feed and clothe, and because we have no savings and no pension plan. I'm just worried that we won't be able to hold all this together. He made a sweeping gesture to take in the clutter, the piles of children's clothes, toys in a plastic box in the corner. For the first time since they'd started talking, Jen felt sorry for him. Did Frank have any other close relatives? She asked. If not, I suppose at least a house in the farm will come to you. Really, I don't think it will. Sarah blew her nose and wiped her eyes with what looked to Jen like a tea towel. Frank always said he didn't believe in inherited wealth. It'll probably have gone to one of his charities. Do you know if he made a will? No, Sarah said. Of course not. It's not the sort of conversation you have with a relative, especially a relative who's your landlord. Did he have a solicitor? Yes. This was John Grieve. He drew up a contract when we took over the management of the farm for Frank. It's a chap called Mason, based in Barnstable. Thanks. Jen made a quick note. She couldn't see how the disposal of Westercombe Farm could be relevant to Lay's death. It would have been hugely significant if Francis Lay had been murdered and the first victim, but surely not now. She turned back to the couple. Did either of you see Frank yesterday? I didn't, Sarah said. I haven't seen him since his party the night before. John? He was up and about first thing yesterday morning when I went out for milking. I walked the cows up the lane but took the shortcut through Frank's garden to get to the field. He was drinking coffee on his terrace, still in his dressing gown. He looked a bit rough. Did he speak to you? Jen was thinking this was probably the last time Lay had been seen alive. He waved. I don't think he said anything, nothing important anyway. Lovely morning, something like that. Did you see anyone else? No. And later? Jen thought this was like getting blood from a stone. She wondered if Grieve was being deliberately obstructive or awkward. You must have walked back past the farmhouse. Didn't you see Frank then? He wasn't sitting on the terrace, John said. He might have been in the house, but I didn't see him. He paused. And that was when I decided to take off, to head over to Spennacott and get a look at the farm there. I was planning what I'd say to Frank, thinking of the business plan I could put together. It would have made sense for him to invest, real sense. We could have fed our meat into his shop, the pub and the hotel he was planning. Sarah would have had more space for a dairy, but we'd have had some independence. A proper place of our own, away from the coast and all the trippers. Now it'll never happen. The anger and depression that had seemed to haunt him when Jen had first come into the house appeared to have returned. You don't know, Sarah said. He might have left us something, enough to buy the place on our own. You know how much he loved the girls. I can't imagine he'd not have remembered them. We need more than an old painting or a bit of costume jewellery from his mother. Grieve turned and left the room. The women were left staring at each other. He'll be upstairs on his computer for hours now, Sarah said.
It's all that calms him down when he's in one of his moods. I'd best get the girls down so they don't disturb him. Is he always as tense as this? There was a slight hesitation before she answered. No. It's such a stressful time, isn't it? 3 deaths connected to the place where we're supposed to feel safe. He just wants to protect us. Jen wasn't sure. She thought again that Sarah was so used to defending him, to herself and outsiders, that it had become a habit. The woman went on. I feel it too. It's as if we're in some sort of siege, that there's an enemy just outside waiting to get us. You know that childhood nightmare when you wake up convinced that there's a monster hiding in a cupboard or under the bed? The dream's so scary because it's like something evil has invaded your personal haven, the place you retreat to when you're anxious or upset. Westercombe has always been my safe place, but in the past few days, I've gone to bed scared. I get up in the night to check the kids are okay. And whenever I get up, I see that John's awake too, lying there, watchful, listening for strange noises in the dark. I don't think he's had more than a couple of hours' sleep since Nigel died. In the morning, we act as if everything's normal. We get the kids off to school and we talk about work. But it's not normal, is it? And it'll never be normal again. She paused and looked dry-eyed at Jen. John's right. Whatever happens, we'll have to move, even if it means shifting into town and doing something boring just to earn a living. At the moment, boring seems bloody brilliant. She stood up. I'm sorry, I need some air. Sarah opened the door and a beam of morning sunshine flooded the room with light. Jen wasn't sure what to say now. She thought her own experience of an abusive marriage might be colouring her picture of this relationship. Earlier, she'd been planning words of reassurance and encouragement. You don't have to stay with him if he's being a shit. Get out while you can. Here's my personal number. Give me a call and I can help. Now she thought things were more complicated than that, or very much simpler. As Sarah had said, the couple were living in the eye of a storm, and all around them was tragedy and chaos. No wonder their nerves were frayed and John had wanted to leave for a while, to plan a future away from Westercombe. Which didn't mean, of course, that Jen wouldn't be searching out CCTV records for the roads leading towards Spennacott to check that his story was true. The women stood together for a moment, just outside the cottage door.